This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Liping Chen, your host for today's episode. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Zhao Tian Chen about his new book, Malaysian Crossings, Place and Language in the Worlding of Modern Chinese Literature. This book was published by Columbia University Press in 2022. Malaysian Chinese literature, or Mahua literature, is marginalized on several fronts. In the international literary space, which privileges the West, Malaysia is considered remote. The institutions of modern Chinese literature favored mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Within Malaysia, only texts in Malay, the national language, are considered national literature by the state. However, Mahua authors have produced creative and thought-provoking works that have won growing critical recognition, showing Malaysia to be a laboratory for imaginative Chinese writing. Highlighting Mahua literature's distinctive mode of evolution, the writers demonstrate that the grasp of their marginality in the world Chinese literary space has been the impetus for rather than a barrier to aesthetic inventiveness. He foregrounds the historical links between Malaysia and other Chinese-speaking regions, tracing how Mahua writers engage in the worlding of modern Chinese literature by navigating interconnected literary spaces, focusing on writers including Lin Cantian, Han Suying, Wang Anyi, and Li Yongping, whose work crafts signature literary languages. Chen examines narrative representations of multilingual social realities and authorial reflections on colonial Malaya or independent Malaysia as valid literary terrain, delineating the inter-Asian crossings of Mahua literary production. It could be physical journeys, interactions among social groups, and mindset shifts from the 1930s to the 2000s. He contends that new perspectives from the periphery are essential to understanding the globalization of modern Chinese literature. By emphasizing the inner diversities and connected histories in the margin, Malaysian Crossing offers a powerful argument for remapping global Chinese literature and world literature. So this is a brief introduction about the book, and now let's hear it from the author. Zhao Tian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Liping, for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. So hello, everyone. Again, my name is Zhao Tian Chan. I'm from the Department of Chinese Studies at the National University of Singapore. My research interests include modern Chinese dinosaur literatures, Southeast Asian studies, and diaspora studies. So besides the book that we're going to talk about today, for which Liping has given a really extensive synopsis, my work has also appeared in journals such as Modern Chinese Literature and Culture and Prism Theory in Modern Chinese Literature. So for listeners who are interested in Chinese and Sinophone literary production beyond mainland China, I would highlight the special issue of Prism on the World of Southeast Asian Chinese Literature, which I co-edited with Carlos Rojas at Duke University in late 2022. So lastly, as a literary translator and editor, I have worked with Renditions, a Chinese-English translation magazine.
All right, thank you, Zhao Tian. And then we are so looking forward to discussing your book. But before that, we want to hear a little bit about how you started this project and any of the inspiration or anything you'd like to share with us the start of this project.
Sure. So the short and banal answer to this would be this project began as a PhD dissertation, as most of us would, because this is the first book. And looking back, I feel extremely fortunate that my application to grad school in the US encountered this significant moment when the Sinophone concept created spaces in the field of modern Chinese literary studies in North America, so that we can study analytic literary formations beyond mainland China. So perhaps Li Ping, actually, we came up from the same moment of graduate school training. So it was really a matter of timing, isn't it? And I'm very grateful for the chance to undergo training in the US. But the longer answer relates to actually an even earlier period of my personal and professional trajectory. I wanted to study Singapore and Malayan / Malaysian Chinese literature at a deeper level because of my earlier vocation in Singapore as a Chinese language teacher and national curriculum planner. So prior to graduate school in the UK and the US, I taught Chinese language and literature to teenagers and engaged in the making of elementary school Chinese language instructional materials at the national level for almost 6 years. The two jobs made me realize how ignorant I was about Singaporean and Southeast Asian Chinese and Sinophone literature and culture, given that the local Chinese language education here in Singapore focused more really on the acquisition of functional proficiency. And when it comes to the literature subject, favored the selection of works from Greater China. So when I left the education service, my sense of inadequacy really, in part, led me to acquire and accumulate more knowledge during my post-undergraduate studies about the different facets of what we commonly here call, what we commonly call here in the region, Xinma Wenxuan, and that is Singapore and Malayan / Malaysian literature.
Yeah, thank you, Chao Tian, for sharing with us the academic journey. And you mentioned that, yeah, we started the journey in the United States around the same time where the Sinophone education gathered more and more attention, right, and also have a lot of the different scholarship start emerging as well. And I also want to thank you for sharing your personal experience and also interest as well, especially in terms of the teaching Chinese language and also do the curriculum planning as well. So with that, and then thinking about the start of this book from the academic journey, but also in terms of this kind of personal experience, personal interest as well. And now, I guess one of the first question I want to start, I mean, about the book is the term Mahua, which actually I mentioned a little bit in the introduction. And then, can you tell us a little bit about what is Mahua? And in your book, this is Mahua literature. And so Mahua literature, how should we situate and position this body of literary work, especially in connection or in confrontation with the Chinese literature and Malaysian literature?
Right. So thank you, Li Ping. This is really an important question because I think to most of our colleagues in the field who don't quite pay attention to Chinese language literary production outside mainland China, Mahua literature should be relatively unfamiliar to them still. So through the lens of the book, I would say Mahua literature can be characterized as this Chinese language literary formation that lives with a condition of deep marginality. So thank you very much for actually reading out the book synopsis. And what I would add is that I also present in the book Mahua literature as a multi-scalar configuration. And by that, I mean the crossings theme in the book marks how Mahua literature embodies global, local, and other regional scales of literary interest as they interact at the same time. So it is important here to outline how Mahua literature is produced. So notably, what I call a literary Malaysia or the literary space of Malaysia does not map completely onto geopolitical Malaysia. So literary Malaysia is actually this aggregated region that comprises primarily not just Peninsular Malaysia and East Malaysia, which is on the island of Borneo, but also on Taiwan, which has nurtured a dazzling contingent of diasporic Mahua writers or naturalized since the 1960s. So we can then think of literary Malaysia as this space, perhaps, that maintains multi-directional historical connections with locales beyond its geographical shores, which would include even mainland China, Hong Kong, and Singapore, besides Taiwan. So from this perspective, I think Mahua literature reminds us that the borders of a literary space may extend beyond that of a nation state bearing the same name. So from yet another perspective, figuratively speaking, we can see how Mahua literature engages modern Chinese literature, not from this satellite position, but from a position that generates its own configurations its own matrix of multiple centers and multiple margins within. So entwined with this varied combinations of center periphery relations, as it overlaps with planetic literary production in many other locales, like what I've mentioned earlier, Singapore, Taiwan, and China. So Wanghua literature actually mediates different types of what I think of as trans-regional ties. So depending on historical period and discursive context, and I think that's extremely important, writers and critics frame Wanghua literature differently. So Wanghua literature can be treated as provincial, seen as a sub-national area of China in the earlier periods of 20th century, for instance, as national when it is seen as being part of Malaysia, Taiwan, or China, or as supranational, for instance, when Wanghua literature is invoked as part of Nanyang literature to refer to Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and then I especially appreciate you highlighted this kind of multi-directional connection and also the trans-regional ties, especially this is beyond the nation-state borders. So there's multiple regions that is sort of kind of decenter the nationalist framework of literature, and also it could be multi-center in this terrain as well. So with this, and especially also this body of literature, how it connect, but also challenges the national framework of Chinese and Malaysian literature. And now we want to hear a little bit about, you know, so in the beginning and the history of Chinese people in Malaysia. So this is about, I guess, the mobility of people and also diasporic community. But can you tell us a little bit about the history or the culture of Chinese people in Malaysia in the colonial time or also the post-colonial period as well?
Yes, Li Ping. So I forgot to mention actually to start, I really break down the term Wanghua literature in the previous section. So here I would just add that the semantic unit of Ma in Wanghua literature actually refers to both colonial Malaysia, which gained independence in 1957, as well as to colonial Malaya, its historical antecedent. So in addition, this Ma that stands for Malaya also indicates this strong popular aspiration after World War II for decolonized peninsula and Singapore to be unified as a nation state. So that's actually the basic historical backdrop to the book. And I think it's important to actually share this with the uninitiated. from that, Malaysia as a geopolitical unit, and just now I probably forgot to actually do this groundwork and I'll share it now. It consists today of Peninsula Malaysia, also known as West Malaysia, and Malaysian Borneo, which is East Malaysia. So it is a multiracial and multilingual society whose ethnic composition, and the figures I have here is for 2021, 69.8% of Bumi, which is this category called Sons of the Soil, that was created by the post-colonial state after 1963 to institute Malays and all indigenous peoples of the country as a group for preferential policy making. So we have 69.8 Bumiputera in 2021. And besides that, there's 22.4% of Chinese and 6.8% Indians. So as we can see, as this separate social category, the Chinese and Malaysia account for a minority, but at the same time, they are also a politically significant planetic speaking community that resides outside mainland Chinese state, Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan. And with regard to actually Chinese migration, there's a huge bulk of it, which is related to the book, that came to Singapore and the Malayan region in late 19th century and early 20th century. And most of them actually come from the southeastern coastal provinces of China, which is Guangdong and Fujian. And we can talk about that more later in the context of Chapter 1, Lin Fantian.
Yeah, and then, yeah, thank you for introducing this, especially you mentioned that the Chinese population in Malaysia is around 24-25%. And then so thinking about this group of people and also their life and also their literary production in Malaysia. And so with that, we will now be thinking about the four writers that you analyze their work that you analyze in your book. And first of all, is the chapter one, and then this is about Lin Zantian. And then can you give us some introduction about Lin, and also thinking about his novel as well? So in your book, you analyze Nong Yan, and then you argue that this actually prompts us to think about, to recognize the different moments, different elements, different factors in the Chinese overseas community. So it's not just one unified, but actually there are a lot of differences, diversities or so. So can you tell us more about Lin Zantian?
Sure. But Li Ping, at one point, perhaps I would also elicit more impressions of your reading of chapter one, but I'll begin by actually a short introduction of Lin Zantian. So in the context of Sinophone Singapore-Malayan literary history, he's best known as the writer who composed Nong Yan, which is the earliest novel in the Sinophone Singapore-Malayan Chinese literary history. So his case study to me brings out the pre-World War II Wanghua literary landscape into sharper focus, because it goes beyond the well-recounted examples of figures like Huang Zunxian and Yu Dafu. And his writing practice really began after he reached Nanyang, and his immersion in the region's cultural environment closely resembled that of the Nanlai Duojia, who enlivened the fledgling Singapore Sinophone literary circles in Southeast Asia. And this is the significance of the case study. As for his background, he was born in rural Zhejiang. And here, this is a significant point, as we will later see, because he does not come from the southeastern coastal provinces of Fujian and Guangdong. He was influenced by the May 4th movement for returning university student to his home village. And then later, he moved to Hangzhou to further his studies. Not just to study, really, but also to escape from an arranged marriage. And he, after graduating in Hangzhou, mirroring this May 4th ideal of self-determination, he resolutely broke away from the marriage arrangements permanently. And he traveled to Singapore in 1927 and left very soon to teach at a Chinese school on the east coast of today's peninsula, Malaysia. His literary debut was in 1929, but it was after his relocation to 1932 to Kuala Lumpur that he eventually settled down to write more consistently in his free time. So the point to note here is that he was not a professional writer. A lot of, I would say, a great majority of the Ma writers are not professional writers. So for Lin Zantian, except for a trip back to China to attend his father's funeral in 1935, as well as a hiatus during the Japanese occupation in the early 1940s, he was engaged with local Chinese education, rising to the rank of a principal of a local school till his retirement in 1964. So in the book Nong Yan, as what you have mentioned and alluded to, Li Ping, I contend that it prompts us to reckon with the internal heterogeneity of overseas Chinese community by fashioning the novel as a social allegory of the Wai Jiang Zhen, which is a minority category of Malayan Chinese that encompasses all non-Fujian and non-Guangdong migrants. So for readers who are unaware, I mean, as I've mentioned earlier, the Chinese and Malaya are largely migrants from the provinces of Fujian and Guangdong. So in the novel, the tale, which represents, I think, the social dynamics in the Ma'hua literary circle as well, suggests Lin Zantian's own suppressed status as a Wai Jiang Ren among southerner writers. So some of his colleagues have written later on about his slightly broader face, and how he spoke Mandarin with a heavy Jiangzhe accent. So he really cut this strikingly different figure in the Nanyang literary field, which was populated by other Wenren, other men of culture from Guangdong and Fujian. And because Lin drew on his personal experience in Malaya for his writings, I would say it's not surprising that he was direct his authorial gaze to examine the circumstances of Wai Jiang Ren through thick smoke. So just a short synopsis of the novel, which primarily uses third-person narration. It recounts the experiences of several new teachers who are working at a local Chinese school in a town located on the east coast of Malaya. And conflict breaks out on many levels, among women instructors, between Indian and Chinese instructors, and over issues such as employment positions and pedagogical issues. Among principals, Among the principal, teachers, and board of directors over the degree of autonomy in school administrative operations, among board members and power struggle to preserve cliquish interests, and between the teachers and students over disciplinary methods. So among this conflicts, and I don't know whether this registers with you, Liping, the clashes between the mercantile local-born Chinese who control the school board of Hokkien-speaking directors and the migrant educators from China who have assimilated into Malayan society unevenly, I think deserves great critical attention. So because the depictions of their conflicts between this local-born Chinese who speaks Hokkien and the migrant educators from China, and in this case from the Jiangzhe region, who does not understand Southern Chinese dialect. The novel explores this conundrums, this predicaments of Waijiangren in this internally divided Mahua community. And we see how Mao Zedong and Li Mianzhi, the two Waijiangren protagonists, and the difficulties in actually carrying out their teaching work in the school. So I would say that the narrative can be read as this tale about living in the margins of the dominant language of a specific place. So, I mean, we'll just stop here for the time being. I don't know whether you have any thoughts to share after reading the chapter.
Yeah, because I think it's definitely, I appreciate you highlighting, especially this kind of like a marginality, and it could be multiple sense of marginality. And for example, the Chinese community in Malaysia, but also within the Chinese community itself, they are also different, as you mentioned, the kind of division among them. And this division will lead to the confrontation as well. So I think this novel, especially the Waijiangren, to think about their experience and to think about those, also the Chinese immigrants, but thinking about they are from the non-major destination, for example, Guangdong and Fujian. So I think this is definitely to think about this multiple sense of marginality, and also how that within the Chinese community itself, there are multiple layers of a division, if not confrontation between them. And I think another thing that you mentioned also is about the local-born Chinese as well. So this local-born Chinese might be having very different experience with these Chinese migrants, and also in terms of their contact and exposure to local culture will be different as well. So I think, yeah, these are some of the things that I'm thinking while especially hearing you are now talking about the book as well.
Yes, absolutely. Because I think in the current state of scholarship, I don't know for your work on Taiwan, whether this would have some kind of relevance as well. We often think of both China and overseas Chinese communities as sort of this monolithic block. But I think if we go back actually into history, we would discover this really interesting internal inner fissures within what to the outside group would think of as a remarkably cohesive overseas Chinese community, for instance, in this case. But actually, it's not. And what I also want to say is that Nongyan, the novel, demonstrates how Malaya plays host to this regional tension that is displaced from China, which gets enfolded into local interests in Nanyang. Mm. And this kind of intra-communal tension has not been sufficiently analyzed in our diasporic Chinese and Sinophone literary studies. But it has been dealt with actually in historical and anthropological research on displaced Chinese communities, especially in Chinese language scholarship, via the parameter called Fangyanqun, which has been rendered as translated as dialect group in existing literature. So in this way, by profiling the social walls of a Sinophone literary site at the neglected resolution, the novel Nongyan really helps us to shift the analysis of global Chinese creative writings from cataloging new productive locations to this scrutiny of internal inner diversities in each locale.
Yeah, and then by extension as well, because now we're talking about the diversity within the overseas community, but also to think about, you know, as China as a nation or Malaysia as a nation state, it itself is also, there's a lot of diversity as well, ethnic diversity, linguistic diversity, cultural diversity as well. So I think this is what this book, Nongyan, actually got me thinking as well. So we are thinking, we are talking about overseas Chinese community, yes, but actually thinking about, you know, their place of origin or where, you know, they call homeland, hometown, it itself is already also diversified, although the national narrative might be very different. It might be sort of narrated or constructed as a unified nation state. But as we can see in the case of the overseas community, we can also reflect on how that national narration about a cohesive nation is being coming into place.
Sure, right, absolutely.
Yeah, and then so with that, and thinking about the writing in here in different position within the communities, but also could be writing in different languages as well. And here we will be moving on to the second chapter where you talk about Han Suying, the writer. And then so first of all, maybe tell us a little bit about the writer herself, and then later on also about her writing language. And then specifically how this, her literary choice, this language, can break the linguistic divides and then also connect to other different language in order to participate in the project for nation building or place making. So just want to hear from you about Han Suying and also the her choice of the literary language.
Sure. So Han Suying was this really colorful personality. And Li Ping, if you have read the chapter, I'm sure you can sense it in fuller. So she's this Eurasian doctor who traveled from Hong Kong to Singapore, to Malaya in 1952. She's perhaps better known for her writings about China during the Cold War or her novel on Hong Kong, A Many Splendid Thing, that was made into a popular Hollywood film. So my chapter, Chapter 2, delves into a neglected stage of her biography, which is her sojourn in Malaya and Singapore from 1952 to 1964. And this stage is really important because it was in Malaya that she ended her physician practice. So she stopped being a doctor and became a full-time professional writer. So what I found incredibly interesting is how even though all the writings were in English, in Malaya she was misunderstood as a Chinese language writer due to the translations of her literary works and her cultural advocacy for the Chinese educated. So one question, Li Ping, I mean, for the first time when you just saw the book, perhaps browsing the contents, you might be wondering why I included an Anglophone writer inside a book on modern Chinese literature. And is this historical misunderstanding that is the premise really of this chapter, and I found this really thought-provoking. So according to the scholar Zhang Xinhong, it was the work of the literary translator Li Xinke, Lai Xinke, an enthusiastic journalist from the Chinese press, who translated her public speeches. Li Xinke translated her novels. So they co-created the popular misrecognition of Han Suying as an author who wrote in Chinese. So this unique entanglement with Maohua literary space is actually seen especially in 1958 when the translation of a third novel, And the Rain My Drink, launched the Literary Arts of Singapore and Malayan book series, Xin Ma Wen Yi Cong Shu, that was published by youth book company, Qingnian Shu Ju, which was well known for its commitment to nurturing Sinophone Singapore and Malayan literary works. And that veritably inducted Han Suying into the field of modern Maohua literature. So this And the Rain My Drink, after being translated, was the only novel selected for two cycles of the series, each with a dozen titles. So this cooperation of Han Suying into Maohua literary space coincided with a rising interest in Malayan content by local bookstores and publishers after a colonial ban on publications from China and Hong Kong in 1958. So her contact with Chinese school students Ed figures in the local Sinophone cultural circle acquainted her with the relative vibrancy of Maghua literary production, whereas her renown as this international best-selling writer would have bolstered the status of the youth book company's Malayan publication. So her dedication to novelistic writing intersected in this way, right? With the Malayan scene enduring reverence for longer narrative form. And it augmented this book series that cultivated local consciousness and paved the way for longer works by writers such as Miao Xiu, Li Rulin, etc., all of whom would later become important figures in the Maghua literary space. So, secondly, so the first is actually the translation of her works, which had great influence. The second part is actually her cultural advocacy for Chinese-speaking Malayans that were widely reported. So even though both local Chinese and English literary constituencies were then not fully visible to reading publics, so Hathaway introduced the effort of Chinese language sphere to the English language sphere through her public speeches, praising the former for mobilizing localized linguistic forms in literature to convey a distinctive stance of geographical and political community. And she role models this, right, in her Malayan writing project, which exemplified her ideas about a method of emulating the localizing orientation of Chinese language in Malaya. So against the backdrop of decolonization, she incorporated Malayan English into her novelistic endeavor, which yielded And the Raid My Brain, which was published, and the sequel Freedom Shout Merdeka, unfortunately, which was unpublished, years before The Cruel in Making was recognized as valuable for literary writings and social identity construction. So I would say that her literary practice demonstrated ways to decolonize English, especially to vernacularize English as an acceptable literary language for depicting Malaya. And the incredibly interesting point here is that she looked to Maghua literature for inspiration, which is another literary formation in the margins. And in so doing, formulated locally inflected English in a Malayan fiction project to reflect hybridized linguistic habits as a way to engage in placemaking and nation building. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I especially appreciate you mentioning this, her practice for decolonize and also vernacularize English, right? And then in a way that writing in the language, but also to think about there may be different inflection with other language, different cultural that can be, you know, kind of represented or kind of different context that this particular literary language could have. And yeah, so I was also thinking about Han Sui, and then also, as you mentioned, the inclusion or the recognition, or I think you also say misunderstanding of Han Sui as a Chinese writer as well. Right. So yeah, so I think this is, there's kind of this kind of sense of irony here that including including Anglophone writers in the Maghua literature, but also at the same time sort of undermining that her literary language choice. And as you mentioned, actually to study her English work, there's a lot we can talk about, the decolonization of English, vernacularized English, and but somehow through literature, through translation, right? So this work, even though it's a translated text, but seems to kind of like receiving more attention than the original Anglophone text. So I think this is something I was also thinking about when, you know, thinking about Han Suying as a quote-unquote Maghua writers, and then the linguistic media, especially for translation, but also how do we sort of bring back this Anglophone layer, Anglophone original text in when we discuss Maghua literature?
Yes, Libby, I'll just add a point of clarification. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, the original works by Han Suying were in English, but the way that she was brought into the Maghua scene was actually through translation. Mm-hmm. And that actually speaks to a way that I would say other social and literary actors sort of expand the repertoire of Maghua works. Mm-hmm. Because there was really, I would say, a relative shortage of works. And bringing in translation of works from other languages into the Chinese language, I'll call it the repertoire of Maghua literary works, is a way of sort of like expanding the corpus, and then in some ways also accruing prestige to the literary profession as well.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. And thank you again for emphasizing on this is about the Chinese translation of her work. And I guess also another question I'm reading, I mean, not just this chapter, but also other parts of the book is also about the linguistic diversity of Manhua literature, right? So yes, you know, this is about Chinese translation of her work, but maybe also we can also think about her original, I mean, text in the English language as well. So this is something that I'm just kind of thinking about, even though this is primarily because of the Chinese translation of her work, but I'm just thinking about, you know, this kind of like linguist diversities, and especially given, you know, Malaysia colonial history, and the English is definitely, I mean, one of the languages there. So yeah, just something that I'm thinking.
Yes.
And so with that, so we are talking about, you know, the Chinese and also Malaysian literary tradition, the English as a writing language as well. And with all this different connection to cultures, to language, to literary traditions, and now we will be moving to the third chapter. And this chapter is actually about Wang Anyi. And specifically, you analyzed her writing and especially her one of her work, Shangxin Taiping, as this kind of cosmopolitan vision as well, and also especially the language that she envisioned to be this kind of cosmopolitan vernacular of Chinese. So I was wondering, can you start with some introduction about Wang Anyi as a writer, and also later on maybe talking about her cosmopolitan vision as well?
Definitely, Li Ping. Yes, so when we talk about Wang Anyi, I think the immediate association as with China and more specifically Shanghai, right? So in this chapter, I want to highlight a neglected part of her heritage. I mean, through her paternal side, which is to Singapore and Malaya, because her father, Wang Xiaoping, was actually born in Singapore. And he went to China after the Second World War broke out, really to help to join this anti-Japanese resistance cause. And then later on, when actually World War II broke out on a larger scale, he was unable to return and then settled down in mainland China. So with regard to actually Wang Anyi's cosmopolitan vision, I think it's important to highlight the historical juncture, and that is the period from the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. And that was a time when actually she traveled out of China, first to the Iowa Writing Program with her mother, and then later on to America, and then later on to Germany, as well. She has written about it. And in 1991, she traveled southward to Singapore, not only as a distinguished guest of literary events, but also as a route seeking descendant who visits her father's native land and the Malayan region, which her father became familiar with through joining a roving drama company that put out anti-Japanese performances. And it was through that trip that yielded the novella Sadness of the Pacific, Shangxin Taipingyang, that's the focus of chapter 3. So in going back to that historical juncture in the 1980s and the early 1990s, Wang Anyi was actually feeling rootless because she was educationally disprivileged during the Cultural Revolution, and she felt disconnected with rivers and mountains as sources of a cultural identity. So she decided to embark on root-seeking endeavors on her own terms. And relating this to Sadness of the Pacific, I think there's a really interesting notion that's recurringly expressed, and that is, on a map, mainlands are also drifting islands. And here the geographic equivalence evokes, I think, an underlying narrative logic that's articulated differently across Wang Anyi's prior works that build up to Shangxin Taipingyang. So the novella echoes its twin narrative, which is this 1993 novel, Ji Shi Yu Xu Gou, Documentation and Fictionalization, which spins this quasi-autobiographical tale about the narrator's maternal family lineage that originates in the Mongolian steppes. So throughout the novel, Ji Shi Yu Xu Gou, Wang Anyi interweaves the narrator's genealogical investigation in the semi-arid landscape with a struggle to actually feel at home in Shanghai, which was once described as the solitary island Guda, right, during World War II, where parts of the city were exempt from the Japanese occupation. So at one point, because of the linguistic barriers in communication and this overwhelming sense of existential rootlessness, the first-person narrator in Ji Shugo compares a migrant family in Shanghai to an island. So in this way, we can see how Wang Anyi strings urban Shanghai together with places beyond the Great Wall and across South China Sea to write fiction during the early 1990s that sort of conjugates her simultaneous interest in global, regional, national, and local spaces of Chineseness, and then embedding her different senses of marginality within. So we can see cosmopolitanism at work here, in my view. So by pronouncing this equivalence between China, the continent, and Singapore, Malaya, the island, in the ending of Sadness of the Pacific, I would say, why is cosmopolitanism provincializes China, which she no longer sees as an exceptional place? A portrayal of drift in Sadness of the Pacific through depicting this ongoing flows of people among places, where China only constitutes one station rather than an originary site for singular departure. So that's the bit about her travels. And Li Ping, her second part was actually about her literary language, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
Yeah. So at the same time, when she was traveling to different places in the world during the 1980s and early 1990s, I noticed that she was also trying to formulate a distinctive literary language of her own. And she wanted to distance herself from her other root-seeking colleagues in China. She didn't want to write the kind of urban party of Wang Shuo. She did not want to develop this kind of literary language that's soaked in localism. So she prefers the A Cheng kind of expression, where she felt she calls it an abstract language, 抽象的语言, a kind of meta language that has the widest applications. So in this way, I characterize this linguistic medium, a preferred linguistic medium for literature as a cosmopolitan Chinese literary vernacular, so by which I mean it's some kind of an all-purpose form of written language that's unbeholden to any social or local constituency. So it aims to connect with the largest possible readership that's made up by Chinese people spread globally, and all of whom are bound by this common destiny of shift. So I hope that is clear, Li Ping.
Yeah, and then especially you are mentioning this, you know, the connection, right? To try to connect to different readership across, national borders, cultural borders, and then to reach as much as the Sino-Korean readers as possible. So I think definitely to think about, you know, how Wang see her work, and also to want to kind of reach to readers in China, but also outside China and in different Sinophone societies and Sinophone communities as well.
Yeah, so she was really developing her own kind of baihua. So she was, in one interview, she talked about how the language that she uses for not just Sadness of the Pacific, but also for Utopian verses, Wubobang Shipian, which was written during the same period. As a combined of art, she thinks that she wants to achieve a certain kind of linguistic transparency that would be intelligible to the widest possible readership. And here I'll add an additional point, which is that in my previous chapters on Lin Caitian and Han Suyin, I have also positioned the way in which they bring specificities of place settings into their literary languages as cosmopolitan as well. So it seems like there's kind of a conflict. I'm being kind of inconsistent, because in the first two chapters, I emphasize place appropriateness. But in this one, I sort of relinquish the emphasis on place specificity. But what I would say is that this contradiction can be resolved if we frame Wang Anyi's case as expanding the conceptual range of universal-minded literary vernaculars. So Wang Anyi's this vernacular can be seen as cosmopolitan because it participates in creating and connecting multiple site-specific cultures in a non-dominant fashion, which contributes towards the international literary language diversity without engaging in domestication. So while local and regional literary spaces are free to incorporate her narrative poetics, which come from a more expensive literary place like China, right? The resultant poetics of local and regional literary spaces actually also travel. They move from Malaysia to other places such as Taiwan and Singapore. So in this way, we can see this dynamic, a really mobile moving ecology of intersecting sectors and peripheries.
Yeah, this kind of mobility, right? So the mobility of the literary practice, the mobility of the language as well, and then also try to reach out to readers across national borders, cultural borders, linguistic borders as well. And so we talk about Lin Sanxian and Han Suying and then Wang Anyi. And now we're moving to the fourth chapter. So this is about Li Yongping. And this is a chapter where, we want, maybe we should start with some introduction about Li Yongping, and also some want to hear you talk about his proximity to China, and then especially in his literary writings.
And this is probably a chapter, Li Yongping, that would pick your interest the most, because I imagine that perhaps the part that touches on Taiwan would be of slightly greater interest to you.
Yeah, so yeah, just definitely want to hear you and share with our listeners more information.
Sure. So a bit of background information about Li Yongping. He was born in late colonial Sarawak in 1947, and then went to Taiwan for tertiary studies when he was 20. And that was 4 years after the Borneo region of Sarawak joined the Malayan Peninsula to form independent Malaysia. So he had begun writing creatively in Sarawak and then subsequently anchored his literary career in Taiwan, where he settled down eventually. So in terms of publication trajectory, his first collection of short stories entitled The Bidanyu Woman Last in Full still features Borneo settings. And that was published in 1976. But after that, he gradually chose to leave his native land behind. And his first novel, Ji Ling Chun Qiu, published in 1986, won him great critical acclaim in Taiwan's literary world and draws readers into, the story draws readers into the tribulations of a timeless locale that bears only faint traces of its land of birth. So the fourth chapter focuses on Li Yongping's writing practice in the 2000s, which returned to depict Borneo, because initially he had left the place behind. And in particular, the chapter analyzes his two-volume novel, Where the Great River Ends, Da Hui Jin Tong. And the bulk of the story is framed by an elderly narrator protagonist in Taiwan who writes about his past spent on a Southeast Asian island. And the novel focuses on the topography of Borneo primarily via the character Shao Lian Yong, the youth, who is the narrator's 15-year-old self, as he joins this mixed ensemble of travel companions on an expedition along the river Kapuas in search of its source on the sacred mountain of Batu Tiban. So, in my view, Li Yongping undertakes literary worlding through the novel in two ways, and it is here that we can see the way that he orchestrates his relationship with China. So first, by deploying the Chinese script to transcribe local and indigenous languages in Borneo, and second, by an elusive representation of native tribes on the island. So I unpack the former contention by comparing the original edition published in Taiwan to the China edition published later. But the PRC edition comes with a preface Li Yongping wrote specially for his China audience, whom he calls readers from my homeland, 祖国读者. In the preface, Li argues for what he called the cosmopolitan development of Chinese language, 中文的世界化. Through his use of Chinese characters to transcribe local languages, it brought you. So in both editions, both PRC and Taiwan editions, his worlding of Chinese as a literary language underpins his novelistic representation of Borneo indigeneity, which is inspired by the flourishing of indigenous writings and studies in Taiwan since the late 1990s. And this part also engages in the dialogue with nativist Sarawak critics, on the topic of whether writers can represent Borneo authentically. So it is in this sense and from this perspective that I position Lee Yong-bing's literary practice as a multi-directional one, a practice that reveals what I call, and you have actually shared it in our correspondence outline, this paradoxical proximity and distance from China at one, and the striking manner in which his self-positioning straddles both intranational and transnational concerns.
Yeah, and then I think you highlighted one very strong example is how he referred to the Chinese reader, in the PRC as the readers in the homeland, in Zhuguo. So I think this is something that to think about how he positioned himself in this kind of like a relation, connection with China, but also think of how he positioned and represents the Borneo, the indigenous community, the languages and the culture, and also how this book is actually published in Taiwan first, the publication outlets and also the hub. So in terms of circulation and publication, I would say it's also a trans-regional intra and national as well. So this is just something that I was thinking about while thinking about this kind of like not just his literary work, but also the context for circulating and also for publication as well.
Right, absolutely.
All right.
I'm so glad that you actually intuitively got the gist and the spirit of this chapter as well as actually the book, Li Ping.
Well, I mean, thank you for an amazing book. So I'm just happy to hear you talk more about it. And so we already talked about the four chapters, but actually, when we are preparing and scheduling this interview, and Charlton told me he's actually on several book talks already. And here, I guess, just want to hear from you a little bit. So now the book has been published for some time, and that you have given some book talks, receiving feedbacks, responses. So anything you would like to share with us, or any thoughts you have on this book project?
Yes. So even though admittedly the topic is rather niche, the book has been generally well received, and I'm very happy about it. And readers appreciate how I foreground the fact that Mahua as a literary region produces not just remarkable text, but also refreshing conceptual frameworks. Because as we probably know, Li Ping, so this kind of a globalization approach to modern Chinese literature and literary history often foreground texts and events of marginalized locales, but we tend to omit what I think of as the lineages of local cultural thought and polemics that invigorate place-based literary production. So besides imaginative texts, Malaysian Crossings also features significant local literary debates and discourses, and it is an approach that that I adopted consciously to rectify the impression that Mahua literary space only produces thought-provoking, fun narratives, and is actually an empty site devoid of its own interpretive ideas. So the fact is actually on the contrary, because Mahua itself is this vibrant interpretive domain, which actively fosters connections between endogenous, which is like site-specific, frameworks, as well as exogenous conceptual influences. So the main example of the Mahua literary thought I introduced in the book is Kim Chiu's notion of the literary Galapagos archipelago, which you probably read it in the introduction, I think.
So
specifically, this literary Galapagos unpacks this marginality that befalls all skills of Chinese literature. Kim Chiu uses it to first position modern Chinese language literature as this Galapagos archipelago of world literature. And then he describes literatures from Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Malaysia as the small island in this literary Galapagos he identifies. And lastly, he switches the scale of his view, and it sets up modern Chinese language literature as this global backdrop against which Taiwan and Hong Kong constitute the small islands in the Galapagos archipelago that is studied from literature. Following from his logic, Singapore and Malaysia occupied even smaller islands in the Sinophone Galapagos, marking a condition that he describes as, quote-unquote, at the margins, within the margins. Mm-hmm. So this example, I think, with this example, I want to show how Mahua writers and critics can also come up with extremely thought-provoking literary thought as well.
Yeah, and then, yeah, as you mentioned, especially in the introductory chapter, you bring up Ahn Kim-cheol's kind of literary conceptualization about this kind of archipelago literary production. And in addition to the introductory chapter, well, you, the readers, you will get to see Ahn Kim-cheol here and there in other chapters as well. So I think... thank you for sharing and also for highlighting your inclusion of Ahn Kim-cheol in the book in the analysis as well. And talking about Ahn Kim-cheol, and then I was just wondering, you know, out of curiosity for some of the behind the scenes questions. So this is a book project, and again, congratulations on a great book. And any material that didn't get to be included in the book or want to hear maybe some of the most unexpected material that you encounter in the writing of this book, or the most interesting material that you encounter in the process of writing this book?
Yes, Liping, sure. I thought I would actually share my research trips to the Han Sui-in collection at the Howard Goodlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University, because she's really this really extremely interesting character. I mean, if for some reason intersects with your work, you should actually visit the archive as well. And if I remember correctly, at that time when I visited the archives in 2011, they had 127 boxes of materials. That's a lot. And that was That's a lot, right? And that's before her passing in 2012. So I would think that after 2012, perhaps her descendants have sent more materials and stuff for archiving. So among the materials I discovered were a set of papers called the Han Sui-in Newsletter. So it turns out that every now and then, Han Sui-in would write to private letters to a select group of friends, sharing her thoughts on her readings, her observations during her Malayan sojourn and her travels, as well as on current affairs. So it's this like free flow kind of exposition, including considerable gossip about people and the times. And then using a concept that we're more familiar today, right? This newsletter practice feels like keeping a private blog, you know, the kind of WordPress blog that you need to type in a password before you can access the writings and materials within. And the newsletters were actually all typed out. And then I learned later that Han Sui-in had got her secretary to do it. So I was thinking, how many Asian writers in those days, that was like in 1950s, can afford to hire a secretary to handle this day-to-day matters, right? And then that sort of offers an oblique indication of Han Sui-in's financial status.
Yeah, and then as you mentioned, this is, from now, it seems like it's a teamwork, right? So Han Sui-in completed writing and things like that, and then there's a secretary, like, you know, typing this, into a formal setting and things like that in order to be sent out and, the following other different things. So I think, to think about the writers, but also the context of the writing, who's actually doing the typewriting as well, right. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's there's some other labor that went into sort of circulating her views, right?
Yeah. And then, so what you say about the secretary, the support team for the writing also reminds me of the Chinese translator of her work, even though, you know, they're not necessarily working together or so. But yeah, as you mentioned, there are some other forms of labor, might not necessarily be creative labor, but there are definitely people involved in here as the secretary, the typewriters, and also the translator, maybe also editor and publisher as well.
Absolutely. Sounds like the work of actually the making of a literary celebrity is more than actually just the author that we think does the work, right?
Yeah. Right. The making of the celebrity or the packaging or the marketing of their work as well definitely takes a team. Yeah.
Right. Oh, Liping, if I may interject, I just remembered about another piece of interesting feedback I received from my book talk that I would love to actually share with your audience.
Of course.
So, so what came up during a few Q&A sessions and some of the written reviews that have been published is how Maha literature today does not appear to be marginal anymore, given the ongoing spotlight on literary formation, on the literary formation in academia, and how one of its most accomplished writers, Zhang Huixin, has recently won the Newman Prize for Chinese Literature. And of course, there's been ongoing critical acclaim and market success of Li Zishu's novel, Land of Floating Customs, which is actually Nicholas Wong's and HKU's translation of Niu Ti, not just in Malaysia, but also in mainland China. I'm not so sure about the reception in Taiwan. Maybe Liping, you have heard some a little about that, but in mainland China, it's tremendously successful. So for me, in my view, there's a need to distinguish between sort of like the ad hoc attention and market success given to previously peripherized literary formations such as Maha, and the continuing fragility of the cultural infrastructure that produces Maha literature. So there's a continuing lack of support by the Malaysian state for Chinese language education. The spaces for literary publication in newspaper supplements are shrinking, and the market for literary output in Malaysia itself is also diminishing. So all this hardly creates a sustainable milieu for Maha literature to survive. I mean, and this accounts for the kind of melancholy that I described that Ng Kim Chiu has in my coda about how he thinks that all this is just ephemeral.
Yeah, and then, yeah, totally agree with you in terms of to see the rising attention, you know, the more and more attention on this Maha literature is whether they are corresponding, you know, kind of supporting network and also supporting a structure for the continuation. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So that thought came up to me because we were talking about the other labor that went into the making of Han Su-in as a celebrity author, right? So I suddenly remembered how Maha literature these days is seen as an important object of study, but at the same time, we will say maybe behind the scenes, or rather the day-to-day kind of cultural infrastructure that goes into producing a sustainable a group of people who continue to write Maha literature, that is actually still not very optimistic. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I appreciate you bring up this point, and especially, I guess, this will to some way, I guess, connect it to my last question, especially about your next project. Is your next project also about Maha literature, or what are you working on right now, if you would like to share with us?
Definitely. So I'm actually now working on a short paper on a thought-provoking resonance between Wang Lanyi and Guo Baohun, the doyen of modern Singapore theatre. Really, this paper really came out from my research during my dissertation, so you can see how long I have been sitting with it. So in 1991, as I've mentioned, Wang Lanyi traveled to Singapore and participated in activities organized through various agencies such as the Singapore Chinese Cultural Festival, the World Language Book Fair, and then the 5th International Chinese Language Literary Forum. So she was there with prominent colleagues such as Long Ying Tai, Zhu Tianxin, Zhong Xiaoyang, and Mo Yan. So in Singapore, she met with many famous local Sinophone cultural figures, but she did not cross paths with Guo Baohun. So what intrigues me is, despite the missed encounter, they displayed remarkable thought convergence during the same period from the 1980s to the early 1990s on cultural marginality. So at the turn into 1990s, both artists contemplated the historical trajectories of impoverished sites of Chinese Sinophone culture. I mean, for Wang Lanyi, of course, it's China, and for Guo Baohun, it's Singapore. So on the one hand, Wang Lanyi reflected on how writers like herself may search in vain for cultural roots in the mainland's geographical peripheries, and extended her observations to the displaced Chinese language in the Singapore, Malaysian region. Guo Baohun noted out a hollowing of the Singaporean national psyche due to alienation from ancestral homelands and the state's overemphasis on economic development. So what is super coincident and striking is how both Wang Yi and Guo Baokun developed this resonant discourses of cultural marginality through this contemplation on being a cultural orphan, being an orphan, embodying this, what I think of as a common structure of feeling that expresses an ancient sense of solitude as China and Singapore both labored to carve visible positions for themselves on the world cultural map. Yeah, so this is actually just something small that I'm working on right now while I search for my second project.
Yeah, that sounds like a great project. And then we definitely looking forward to reading more of your work in the future as well. And Zhao Tian, I just want to thank you for being on the show today. And then I really enjoy our conversation.
Thank you very much, Liping. It was really a pleasure to talk to you. And hopefully your audience will enjoy our conversation as well as the book.
I'm sure they will. And I also want to thank the audience for staying with us to the end. I hope everybody's taking good care and see you next time. Goodbye.